Welcome to Unbridled Aloud, a series of conversations with writers laced with a little bit of reading, sponsored by Unbridled Books. I'm Kay Callison. On this edition, we're talking with Pamela Thompson about her debut novel, Every Past Thing. This is a story inspired by a vivid and haunting family portrait that hangs in the Smith College Museum of Art in Northampton, Massachusetts, and graces the cover of the novel. The artist is Edwin Romanzo Elmer, who lived with his wife Mary and their extended families in the wildly beautiful Berkshire Hills, very near where Pam Thompson herself lives with her husband and two children. It's called Mourning Picture, as in grief, and it was painted soon after the death of their daughter Effie. Here's how it begins.
With the ones we love, we know from the start the story's end. Death will come to one of us, and we three will be two, and the two finally one. The sun will set and rise again, and after our sleep, if there be sleep, we will stir only to find that heartache knows no rest. Still, it sears straight through and burns hottest along the edges of our shoulder blades. How fragile we are there. The wings we once had have been broken, and the sky is far beyond us. We will not see that place again. I would not have seen that sunrise if I hadn't been watching over her. It wasn't meant for anyone human to see. Its brilliance, the orange fire of it, was not of this world. Or if it was only our own sun rising in the sky, then life was so terrible, so wide, so beyond us that death itself seemed very small. More human, for how, lit by such fire, nestled in such power, could such small beings hope to survive? How long could we expect life to stay in the delicate and precise arrangements that are our bodies? Every rise and every fall of her chest I watched. I unfolded and refolded a damp cloth to press to her brow, and I watched her skin for signs. Do not think I guessed this day would come. She had been such a healthy child. Last I knew, it was summer, and she and Maud were skipping down the road to Goodnow Stream, big girls, bold, with thick braids and loud voices and enormous appetites. Or she was rolling down the hill with her father, the two of them cock-a-doodling like roosters. Their voices came to me through the kitchen window. But that morning, in the presence of the terrible orange light, no voices came. All sounds below muffled, imagined at most. Yet they had been, once, all of my existence. I understood then how small my own part in this life. After she died, the sky was gray and cold. I noticed this only later, in the afternoon, among people. Edwin, the doctor, Samuel, and his Maud with her giant lily. And then I wondered, was that fire her leaving? Or had the fear inside me dreamed such a sun? I left the parlor and went outside and stared up at the sky. The empty gray expanse, that fire's diffusion. How was I to believe a winter sky so dull contained all that light? I knew then something about people and their quiet, how little we know of anyone, each of us with our skin covering and fixing us in place, and our eyes carrying us by, our small lives and such brilliant light. The Green Book of Mary Jane Elmer. Effie Lillian Elmer, dearest, 29th of June, 1880, until the 3rd of January, 1890.
Pamela Thompson, reading from the opening passages of Every Past Thing. The lives of Mary and Edwin Elmer, as imagined by Pam Thompson, unfold over the course of 1 week in New York City at the turn of the 20th century. They've come from their home in the Berkshire Hills so that Edwin can study art at the insistence of his older brother Samuel, who is paying for everything. Samuel had moved to the city 10 years earlier with his daughter Maud shortly after Effie's death. For her part, Mary, a devotee of Ralph Waldo Emerson, is trying to make sense of her life by writing what she calls her Green Book. She's also trying to find her long-lost love, Jimmy Roberts, who as a 17-year-old pre-med student had spent the summer at their house when Mary was 24 and Effie a little girl of 4. They had corresponded for several years after that summer as he became a doctor and an anarchist, a friend of Emma Goldman's, caring for the poor in the slums of New York City. Along the way, Mary is befriended by Frank Tannenbaum and his sister Susanna, charming, smart, and attractive, quintessential turn-of-the-century bohemian activists. Susanna, the age that Effie would have been had she lived. Beyond exploring how and if a marriage can survive the death of a child, Every Past Thing is a story about deep family relationships. And mostly it's about Mary's learning to connect and live in the present by coming to terms with a loss in the past so profound it's put two people's lives and marriage essentially on hold. Pamela Thompson started out in life as a PK, a preacher's kid, in a small town in upstate New York. She claims not to have been a juvenile delinquent, but a good girl who rebelled by reading. She took the master's degree in creative writing at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, where she studied with John Edgar Wideman. Before that, she graduated from Yale, where she majored in women's studies and edited the university's feminist journal, Aurora. I asked her why, when she took Mary and Edwin to New York City, she chose to put Mary into the very exciting political milieu of turn-of-the-20th-century bohemianism and anarchy.
It's a fascinating time period, really, for me. And I also just really saw connections between the sort of Massachusetts facts of their lives and the fact that I had Mary reading Emerson and sort of being a devotee of Emerson. And I think there's actually a really direct line in American thinking between those transcendentalists and really specifically Emerson and then the anarchists and Emma Goldman. But yeah, I was interested in just following that impulse, and so that's what led me to the anarchist bar, which really did exist in
Schwab's.
Exactly that spot.
Schwab's. It's now a hookah bar, I understand.
That's what when I last looked at the address, which is actually over a year ago now, but we'll see. When I go to New York this fall, I'm going to
see if it's still a hookah bar.
I might even actually have to go in there and smoke, although it will probably make me sick.
That is one thing that I really enjoyed about Every Past Thing. You're portraying an America that's still haunted by the Civil War, and you carry that sense of continuity of the Civil War, as some people thinking of it as the first modern war, and being the beginnings of what we now call modernism.
To me, one of the real pleasures of working in history, where, you know, the more I read and the more I thought about it, the more you understand these connections in a very intimate way, where, you know, it feels like you're talking about people in your family, you know, mm-hmm. Like that's when Aunt Mary was born. I think actually there's a sort of throwaway line of Emerson's about how all history is really biography, and I realized that has always been how I've learned history. It's, you know, sort of more from being an inveterate reader of biographies. And so as I was writing just who Mary was, who Edwin was, I more and more just saw connections to the history that I learned, and that Mary's life does encompass the Civil War and the beginnings of modernism and World War I.
What were some of the challenges of writing from history, and what were some of the advantages?
Well, I mean, I think the challenge is sort of the obvious one that everyone feels, which is that someone could tell you were wrong.
Uh-huh.
Those things that you know that you're, you know, giving critics or readers an opening for attack, which no one wants to do. But, you know, that's so trivial compared to the, you know, the pleasures of working with history. You know, there was just always more to know and more to investigate. So sort of on a dry day or week of the writing, I could just read, and then finding some interesting detail that just seemed perfectly to do with the characters of the story, you know, was there. You know, it's like someone's helping you. Many people, perhaps, are helping you. I knew that their daughter, Effie, had died 10 years before they went to New York. I knew they went to New York for Edwin to study painting. And I knew that they came back from New York together, sort of a bit like walking through a graveyard where you see someone's starting and ending dates. And I, you know, that's really where I thought about the first lines of the novel, about how, you know, we know from the start of anything the end. So those were the facts I knew. And then within that, the central drama for me was that I never knew until I finished writing whether or not Mary would find Jimmy Roberts.
Mm. You know, I wanted to ask you directly, how did Ralph Waldo Emerson get into the mix of the actual novel here for you, with Mary's being an extreme devotee and a reader of Emerson?
Well, for me, one of the fascinations about Emerson is just how incredibly generative he was. And I think also that he can have that strange position that once someone becomes iconic or canonical, of being more talked about than actually read.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I feel like actually reading Emerson, that the guy is so lively, you know,
mm-hmm.
and that's what interests me, is the absolute vivid poetry of the best of Emerson and the wildness of it, the quirkiness. And, you know, I wanted to just think about how Emerson could be alive for someone.
The overwhelming message of Emerson, and you use one of his lines as the epigraph to the novel, is, "The sun shines today also. Why would we dress the present in the masquerade of the past?" But in fact, that's Mary's problem.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, I would read it slightly differently than that, or I guess I would say that I think that he was so often, you know, writing in the imperative like that, and you know, writing a sentence like "the sun shines today also" to convince himself.
Mm-hmm.
But he speaks to her so much because he really perhaps had some of the same struggles.
Oh, yes, the death of his son. She's very much identifies with that part of Emerson.
Right.
But it's really a transcendental lesson that she learns in the course of the novel, of be here now, be present.
Yeah.
And that's a really major revelation for Mary.
Yeah. The thing that I am most interested in Mary is her quality of saying yes, you know, which I find Emersonian. And, you know, when she thinks of herself as, you know, "I am the girl who answers the knock at the window," that is how I think of her. And so my thinking about Mary also is thinking about the kind of people who are sort of like radically accept what they're given. And they're always compelling people who do this, and I did see Mary as a compelling figure in this way. And there's all sorts of unflattering ways of looking at it. Like, she's willing to climb out her window and screw whatever man shows up out there. You know, you could just say it like that. But what does it mean when a person who has that kind of acceptance of life and acceptance of what comes her way, what happens to that person when what comes is their daughter dying?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it seems to me that part of saying yes, or part of accepting the fact that a daughter has died, is like, where would you live and how would you live? And wouldn't you perhaps, you know, really think about another world the way she does, and really think about how the dead can live,
mm-hmm.
but Effie is with her, and is that really living in the past?
Pamela Thompson, talking about Every Past Thing, and I'm Kay Callison. Here's a scene that directly addresses some of the things we've just been talking about. It also shows how well Thompson vivifies the world of New York City at the turn of the 20th century. Maud is Samuel's daughter and very close to Mary and Edwin. She's most unhappy with her dad for having married what we'd call a trophy wife, and on her way to Seattle to teach school. The two women are out on the town, walking from the Upper East Side clear down to Union Square, headed for an Emma Goldman rally. Frank Tannenbaum, who is by this time smitten with the much older Mary, also makes a crucial appearance.
Mary and Maud walk across town, the building shielding them, until they turn down Park Avenue and the wind takes over, rushing down the long corridor, kicking up the dust of dried leaves and horse manure and soot. They link arms and hold their hats and go where the wind blows them. In Union Square, a throng has gathered, despite the wind. Maud and Mary have the ballast of linked arms. They are delighted by the commotion, by each other, by the wind itself, though they forge complaint, squinting their eyes and talking themselves hoarse. Maud looks sideways at Mary, who has realized all at once that people are making way for the woman she'd seen leaving Schwab's, the one who laughed, and that, "It's Emma Goldman," Maud says. "You know her?" "Of course not, but I have heard of her. I'm not a child, you know." "That I know." Had she been condescending? "I just didn't realize. We never discussed politics of any sort." Maud finishes Mary's dropped sentence. "Oh, politics. We're always complaining over dinner, over the paper. Tell me what you think of Emma Goldman." She has more principles in her pinky fingernail than McKinley has in his entire body, and Mary cannot help but laugh, because Maud is so much like Samuel, no hesitation giving her opinion. "What's funny? It's true. You're probably right. I don't know either of them." "That's not a reason not to have an opinion, isn't it?" "No. You can read. Surely you don't think I should believe the newspapers. In that case, I would think you're Emma Goldman some sort of child molester." "So you have to read more, not less." Mary laughs again. "You've become a school teacher since I last saw you. My dear, it's not that I disagree. I wanted to come here for myself." "You did?" "I did." "Oh." Maud smiles. "But it's a problem, isn't it?" "What?" "So much disbelief. Can't believe the newspapers, can't believe the president, can't believe the preacher. I can't believe the words coming from my own mouth. Before I speak aloud, it seems I always retract, readjust, find the flaw. Does that happen to you?" "Wait," Maud says. Emma Goldman has begun to speak. Maud wiggles her arm a little further into the crook of Mary's elbow. "We'll talk after," Maud whispers. "To grow with a child is her motto. Mrs. Alving is the ideal mother." "Who is Mrs. Alving?" Mary whispers to Maud. "Ibsen's heroine in Ghosts." "Because she has outgrown marriage and all its horrors, because she has broken her chains." Mary turns to Maud, widening her eyes to let her know, "This is news to me. I've never even read this Ibsen." She worries how Maud will take such gloom about marriage. She is before all that. But Maud looks straight ahead now, stretching up to see Emma Goldman over the crowd. "Misunderstood and shunned, love rarely takes root. And if it does, by chance, by luck, by grace, it soon withers and dies." Mary had not expected this. Love? Emma Goldman talking of love? Not imperialism or economics? Love withers and dies? Well, why shouldn't she speak of whatever she wants? What else has she thought an anarchist would do? Why should any boundary stand between home and all other human institutions? Mary is conscious of two things, Maud's arm through her own and the force of Emma Goldman. She's so short, so small, yet her voice cuts through the wind. Mary listens, and yet it does not feel like listening so much as feeling as the body responds to song. "I was growing with a child once. She's not alone. Motherhood a subject for a speech. Love's flourishing, something to be studied. By chance, by luck, by grace." She likes those words. She thinks of Jimmy Roberts jumping from the carriage, holding up his hand to help one of his sisters down. "How has it come to be," she had written him once, "that your words have become my own?" It must have been his first letter about Emma Goldman that she'd been answering. "You gave to me the words I wished to say, had I the experience to find them." How strange that when her heart lifts, she finds Jimmy Roberts there still. Except not Jimmy Roberts exactly, but something he left in her, something shifted, not his voice, but something grown from it. Mary has lost track of Emma Goldman's speech, Jimmy Roberts, and then Emerson has knocked on her door, and she sees his fly hitting the window glass, and her own stubborn efforts to understand made manifest, every day the beginning again. What can she give? Has she anything? Her heart pounds so hard she can feel the blood running through her body, and she can no longer think, except, "Let this moment go on and on until I catch up to it. Pay attention, Mary Elmer. You have long wished to be here." These days in which she has fiddled and stumbled, undoing her plans and stalking their opposition, with grief everywhere flickering, here, now, she wants nothing but what she has. Nothing but this tiny woman before her, with a voice stronger than her size should allow, her words edged with the elegance and lilt of other tongues, Russian, German, Yiddish, words at home in the wind. She does not fight what nature offers, and nature cruel at the moment and loud, rough and sturdy. Life is sturdy, Mary thinks. How is it this woman knows, rolls up her sleeves and fights back undeterred? Her speech comes through the lulls in the wind, and Maud's warmth is constant with the promise of after. They will talk. They will talk of this Ibsen she has never read, and Emma Goldman's speech, and Edwin and Samuel and the canvas in the study. She will give Maud the pages she has written of their family history, and maybe she will write others, too, and send them to her across the continent. Not everyone is spellbound. From 14th Street, a procession of horses with blue-uniformed policemen riding straight in their saddles. At the edge of the crowd, a fraying. Whistling barefoot boys throw an old hat back and forth. A few workers wander away. Frank Tannenbaum spots Mary from across the crowd, and he makes his way toward her as the shouting all around becomes louder than speech, louder than wind.
What about the question of marriage? The portrait that's given is kind of, I guess you'd use the word problematic, about the very question of marriage. Does this reflect your own point of view about marriage, or was there something you were trying to work through in using marriage as sort of a metaphor?
Yeah, you know, I never really wanted to get married, and it's always something that I suppose troubled me about the idea of marriage. But I think it's, you know, it's also not just marriage, it's how you have a relationship with any person that matters, you know, over time. I mean, how you can be intimate with anyone, really intimate, for a long period of time. And so, you know, it's about mothers and daughters and sisters and brothers and brothers and brothers as well.
And sort of like kind of a marriages within marriage, this family. Mary and Samuel have a past here. There's always this unspoken, well, secrets. This novel is about secrets that they keep to themselves and that they keep from others. And Mary says secrets are our only solidity, that the unspoken is a web that holds us in place. And she asks the question, are secrets the frame we build our lives upon?
You know, I think that essentially, I mean, I did want to think about something about, you know, how people are alone and how people preserve their aloneness. And that does have to do with secrets, and that major life-changing secrets or tiny ones, whenever those things are said, then actually the frame, you know, the stiffness of whatever was happening kind of crumbles. And so they do give us the illusion of solidity, I think.
You've said someplace that your interest as a writer is in rendering consciousness. Could you expand on that?
Sure. Well, I think that one of the questions that go on in our culture is about the place of the novel, and, you know, many people asserting that there's no need for it anymore. You know, it seems to me that the place of the novel is maybe now doing things that other forms can't do so well. And I think, you know, the thing that film does so magnificently is dialogue and action. And so part of me feels like, why do dialogue and action when you could make a film if that's what you want to do? Which is not to say that every past thing is devoid of either dialogue or action, but they're not the central moving things, I think, of the book. And so rendering consciousness, it's what there is to do if you're writing a novel, I think. And that seems very important in this culture, you know, to sort of make something go slowly enough to assert that there is an individual, you know, and a sort of irreducible individual, and that there are different individuals within the novel who, you know, think differently from each other and don't necessarily intersect where we want them to intersect. It seemed important to me to convey something about people's separateness. I mean, what I think about when I try to answer this question is actually the story of what happened to Mary's writing versus the story of what happened to my writing this novel. One of the things that I didn't know in writing the novel was I didn't know, to me it felt like a huge drama that Mary was trying to write this green book, and that she had you know, an idea about setting out to write something that she hadn't managed to write before. And she having a conversation with Emerson about how she'll do it and mm-hmm. that she'll say what she learned from her grief or whatever it will be. Is it a family history? It's not quite clear. But as I was writing, I felt earlier on that her progress of writing would parallel mine, you know, and that I would learn in writing the novel what she learned in writing the Green Book, and that those voices would somehow be mixed together. And that at a very liberating moment, I realized actually that Samuel was right about Mary, and that in fact she couldn't actually finish the Green Book, or, you know, that she wouldn't really write it, and that she's not precisely a writer. But in fact, you know, one of these people who's more like Samuel, and that more of her art in the world has to do with, you know, conversation and thinking aloud and doing things also, you know, that she really makes things, and that's more who she is.
Mm-hmm. Ironically, like Edwin, isn't that ironic?
Yeah.
The
yeah.
only way he could say his grief and his love for her is to create this painting. And,
right.
And what does he say when he presents it to her?
I've done the best I could.
I've done the best I could. Does that mean he's apologizing somehow to Mary at all for his failure to respond adequately to her grief, to his running Samuel off when he sees them together clutching the sheets, you know, from Effie's death sheets? Or does
yeah.
it mean, this painting here, Mary, it's the best I could to tell you
yeah.
our grief?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that it's like, you know, for Edwin, or when a person says that at the end of, you know, finishing writing a novel or making a painting, I mean, that's it. You know, that's the sort of acknowledgement that, you know, I did this thing to this fullness with everything I had, you know, on this day, in this year, in this week, and, you know, it's over now.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think it's a sentence that allows the next thing to happen. And I think that in a way, what Mary's looking for is the ability to say that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a different kind of thing, but the way that she's present at the rally, or the way that she's present that night, everything that follows in Schwab, it's not the same as making a painting, but for her, it's, I am here and actually fully trying to.
Yeah, that she's finally able to pick up life where it
yeah.
is after being frozen in her grief for so long.
I mean, she's opening the window.
Mm-hmm. Right, she's opening the window again. If someone were to ask you, is there one thing that you, as a novelist, would really like the reader to take away from Every Past Thing, what would that be?
You know, I guess I would like something of that spirit of looking at a person sitting across from you and thinking about what Mary discovered and wrote in her journal after her daughter died, of thinking about that sun in the sky and how it's the same sky later that looks so gray and as though there's nothing in it. And I think it has to do with, you know, looking where there seems to be nothing and knowing that there's fire instead.
Mm-hmm.
So looking at other people like that, thinking about what the fire is in them.
Pamela Thompson, thanks so much for taking time out of your busy day to talk with us about your first novel, Every Past Thing.
Oh, and thank you for reading it so carefully. It's a pleasure.
Pamela Thompson on Unbridled Aloud. This series of podcasts is sponsored by Unbridled Books, who promise you that rarest of pleasures, a good read. Other writers we're talking with include Margaret Cesare Thompson, Michael Pritchett, and our old friend Mark Estrin. For more information about Every Past Thing, along with other titles from Unbridled Books, check out their website at unbridledbooks.com. You'll find all kinds of interesting stuff there, including a long list of literary links and book study guides for most of their titles. This program was produced by Kay Callison for Unbridled Books. For other interviews with authors of fine prose conducted by Kay Callison, also known as Kay Bonetti, go to the American Audio Prose Library website at americanaudioprose.org. The music is by Tom Andes from his solo piano CD, One Voice. You can find it on Amazon.com. For Unbridled Aloud, this is Kay Callison.